This is HPR episode 2623 entitled Actors and Agents, Sprites and Fractals. It is hosted by Clacky and is about 57 minutes long and carries a clean flag. The summary is, in which I sit down with C. Weber and try to keep it short, but end up with an hour of tangents.
This episode of HPR is brought to you by archive.org. Support universal access to all knowledge by heading over to archive.org/donate.
Hi, I'm Clacky, and I'm here with Christopher Lemmerweber. And the last time we talked, you were Christopher Allen Weber, but that's a long time ago, and a lot of things have happened.
Yeah, one thing that happened is that I started collaborating with somebody named Christopher Allen, and there's already a Christopher Weber person in the free software community. And there are a few other naming conflicts, and I decided to my wife is Morgan Lemmerweber, so I'm like, well, I'll do that.
Yeah, that's a good idea. It's pretty funny that we're discussing this, and you're actually doing research on how to name things now. So that's pretty suitable. So the last time we talked, that was December 2015. But for HPR listeners, that's actually January 2017, and that's not a mistake I made now. That's a mistake I made then. I let it linger for a year, procrastinating and wanting to edit it, and finally I just let it go. So I'm going to try to be faster this time.
Cool. Yeah, so I'm excited to talk. I guess we have an agenda, so should we jump straight into it?
Yeah. Chris and I are both Racket users these days, and we hang on the Racket users mailing list, and we are working on similar but not quite the same thing. So Chris is now working with an actor model library in Racket, and I'm working on a flow-based programming library in Racket. So Chris, what's the actor model?
Okay, so the actor model is a pretty old idea. The general idea is that you've got actors are just entities somewhere. They have an address that you send messages to, and the kind of computer science-y idea, let's see if I can do it off the top of my head because I didn't put up, but is that I think that an actor can do a few things. It can receive a message, it can send a message, it can spawn another actor, and it can change its behavior in response to the next message. But in general, it's really you're kind of setting up some object somewhere and you're just kind of shooting messages back and forth. A lot of things can be perceived as actor model systems. So almost any time that you have multiple servers sending messages around to each other, that can be perceived as an actor model system. And one nice thing about a lot of actor model systems like Erlang, and also what I'm trying to do with my systems, is that if you it often doesn't matter where the actors are. So there's not really a big distinction between message passing against a local actor versus message passing against a remote actor, if that makes sense.
How do the actors find out what other actors they want to talk to?
So they get a message. In general, it's that they get a message from some other actor that, you know, ends up telling them about things. So you do have some sort of minor bootstrapping problem. Presumably, there's either initial conditions like so I might spawn an actor, and then when I spawn it, you know, if you think about the character of some sort of object or something like that, there may be it may come preloaded when I spawn that actor with, you know, references to other actors. Or I can send it a message like saying, you know, like, oh, well, you know, the next time, you know, you send out, you know, your interesting timing, like update about some sort of news feed or something, tell my buddy over here, right? And I give that actor a reference to it. And then at that point, you know, it can store that in its local state.
Right. Or you could receive a message like, I would like to know something that you know, and here's the inbox that I would like you to send it to, right?
Right. So, and that actually gets into an interesting thing, which is, you know, you actually just described a way of doing kind of request response things, right? Because by default, actors don't, if we think about HTTP, HTTP kind of builds in request and response into one thing, right? You send a request, but then you just sit there and wait until a response comes back, right? And in the actor model, you're generally not doing that. You're sending a request, and then the other actor presumably at some point might send a response back to you. You don't have any guarantee of that. And that's, I guess I'm jumping ahead a bit. That is something that in both kind of all the actor model systems that I've worked on, Zud and 8sync and now Goblins for Racket, I've kind of, since that's such a common thing to do, I've tried is to, it's, you know, especially because programmers are used to being able to invoke some sort of function or method and then get some data back kind of as a return value. I've always made it so that that kind of behavior is as simple and as invisible to the user of the actor model system, even though it technically is that you've sent some sort of message and then you've sent a please respond back type behavior there.
Okay, so the actor model is basically, it's asynchronous in its original base conception, but in the systems you have made, you've always sort of layered an RPC layer on top of that.
That's right. That's right. So you can, so you don't, that's exactly it. So it's basically you've got, and what I really have liked to do, and in the Python version of things, so if people are familiar with async.io, you've got coroutines, and JavaScript recently picked this up. And so Node.js has something similar with async. You can do the whole, you can set up all of your coroutines so that they kind of, they're generator-based coroutines or generator style where they kind of each move a little step. And through that, you can, instead of having kind of callback hell, you can, it can kind of look like you're just calling some sort of function. And then when something's ready, it resumes this function that was suspended. The main problem with Python and JavaScript is that since this wasn't really baked into the language, you kind of have to make sure each one of the functions that you're going to be chaining together, you have to kind of align them like gears. And if each one of these gears, suddenly you have kind of a circle that doesn't have these knobs on it, you can't carry forward that automatic coroutine-like behavior. What's nice in schemes like Guile and Racket is that they support continuations, or I guess delimited continuations, which means that this type of behavior is even more invisible to the user, and you don't have to align any functions. You don't have to mark a function as specifically an async function. Any function can do this type of suspend behavior.
That sounds like an HBR episode on its own.
Yeah, I suppose I went on we're going to keep each one of these things nice and succinct, and I already started going on a tangent there.
Yeah, the whole delimited continuations thing just keeps popping up. And I think at some point I knew what it was, and then I forgot about it again. But let's not dig into that for
right
now.
I think it's nice to it's probably important to emphasize, though, that delimited continuations or coroutines in general are not required for the actor model, though. That's something that I've layered on top of the systems that I've built.
Right, okay. Yeah, the actor model doesn't really say much about things on the API level, right? It's very conceptual, and then people invent it over and over in different implementations for whatever is suitable for what they are using the actor model for.
Right. Lots of people invent the actor model over and over again and don't realize it's an actor model. Right now, people are currently calling microservices microservices, and really they are actor model systems that kind of don't know that they're the actor model.
That's a fun little comment, because we are calling our flow-based programming systems microservices.
Quack, what is flow-based programming?
So flow-based programming is a model where in the actor model, you talked about sending things to inboxes that you somehow figured out where they are. Maybe you got a message, or maybe you configured it somehow else. And every actor has one inbox. In flow-based programming, each component in the system, and in the actor model, they're actors. In flow-based programming, we call them agents. And each agent has not just one inbox, it can have several ports, they're called. And an agent in the flow-based programming model has several in ports, and it has several out ports. And that's all the stuff that it knows about where to get and where to send data. So the idea is you write these agents, and then you wire them together on a higher level. So you start by creating all these small microservices or agents or components that each are like a black box that has inputs and it has outputs. And then you take these and you wire them together in a sort of different layer than you write the code. So that's one part of flow-based programming, is you have the agents and you have the graph that connects the agents together. And then another thing with flow-based programming is that each edge between two nodes in the graph, so from one agent to another agent, there's an edge, that means the communication channel between them, that is by design a bounded buffer. So that if you have one agent just keep spewing out messages, if the other agents aren't listening and taking care of those messages fast enough, then that first agent that is sending the messages is going to block until the buffers start getting the messages start getting peeled off the buffers. So there's a sort of flow control model built into it. Well, there's flow in the name, so and the idea is there's some initial message that comes into this graph of agents, and that message sort of results in a wave of messages going through the network. So you can imagine if something goes from left to right in a graph, you can see the message coming in at the left, and then there's this sort of wave of activity going right, and then maybe the next message comes in, and then you have these sequential waves of activity going through the graph. One concrete example of a flow-based programming network would be some kind of, for example, image processing. I've worked before on a system that was handling camera input and trying to detect objects, classify the objects, and maybe generate some safety action, like braking the car or helping the driver steer back into the correct lane or something like that. And so then you have a continuous feed of here's an image, now we have another frame of our maybe 30 frames per seconds video stream or whatever. And for each frame, there's some analysis done, like here we add the metadata for this, and then in the next step, we add the metadata for this. And then in the end, you have some outputs that actually go into feeding back into the system that now you should take some kind of action. That's kind of the typical flow-based programming network.
So you and I had a number of exchanges about this on the Racket users mailing list, and not to get into the Racket part of it yet, but I think one of the things we were trying to figure out is the way in which flow-based systems are the same as and different from actor model systems, right? So maybe that would be interesting to explore, since I think, as we both said, we both of us are like, oh, microservices, those are technically our thing. And so maybe we should try to figure out how these connect together. And I'm going to posit one thing that seemed kind of clear and see whether or not you think this is right. It seems to me that flow-based programming systems are a little bit more like circuits, where they're kind of fixed. Is that right?
conceptually, that is right. And that's how I thought it needed to be when I got into this. But then it turns out the way we use this is, well, at any given moment, the network is fixed, but we also allow ourselves to modify it. And I'll get into that later when I talk more specifically about why we use flow-based programming and or what we use them for. But some systems, like the one I was telling you about that's in the car, that's like built at compile time. But what we're doing, if we're building a GUI and we want it to react dynamically to something happening, we also allow ourselves to add new agents and add new edges to talk to those agents in runtime. But you can say that at any moment, there's still like this fixed graph that describes the whole flow of the data through the system.
Okay, right. I guess I'm going to throw in a different theoretical computer science system. So there's also, I'm trying to remember the name of it, communicating sequential processes, which is kind of, in many ways, which is actually what I'm building Goblins on top of, because that's what Racket uses for its async system, as communicating sequential processes. In many ways, it seems very similar to flow-based programming, in that have a some sort of process that can have multiple channels that it can send messages to and listen to messages coming from. And like you said, it doesn't, unlike the actor model, there's not one specific inbox that's kind of keep returning to. I wondered if you've looked at communicating sequential processes and have noticed some sort of way in which it's different from that. Is there some clear difference between flow-based programming and CSP, something that one has that the other doesn't?
I think the main feature of flow-based programming and what it's good for is that you have these restrictions on how things are allowed to interact. So I know that you use the Racket async channels for Goblins, and we also use async channels for implementing our flow-based programming Fractalide framework. So it's pretty clear that each of these systems can be expressed in the other, because that's actually how we implement it. I think what flow-based programming offers is not so much all the things you can do, but it's more like these are the things you restrict yourself to so that you can reason about the system. So what you can do is understand the system, I guess, is the feature.
So you mentioned that you had in the car and imaging system that you had kind of compile time, kind of static analysis that you were doing of it. Do you lose some of the ability to reason about things when you've allowed the ability to kind of dynamically connect things?
Oh, I'm sure we lose something in that. And at the moment, where the tooling is, we've also lost other things. Originally, Fractalide was written in Mozart Oz, which is a multiple paradigm programming language that is used in teaching programming concepts. And then for practical use, Dennis and Stuart made a Rust implementation, and that had strict typing on all the edges. And now we're in Racket and we're not doing that anymore. So we definitely lost a lot of compile time checks, and everything is a little bit more freewheeling now. But we're going to find ways to further restrict that again once we got everything put together. But right now we're in very rackety and very live coding kind of mode.
Well, is this a good time to switch over to Racket, or should maybe we should talk about Racket and then the object capability stuff? What do you think, since we're kind of started moving in that territory?
Yeah, so let's go into Racket. You implemented HSync for the actor model before on Guile. So Why are you now on Racket implementing your Goblins actor model implementation?
So the real reason I started, so what happened was at the end of last year, actually, my spouse and I were talking about how she started doing programming within the last few years, and she's an academic. And we were like, well, you know, a lot of these academics don't realize how helpful, like a lot of people in the humanities don't realize how helpful programming tools could be to them. We could probably run a workshop. And I just kind of said, oh, Racket might be a good fit because they've got Dr. Racket and, you know, they've got this thing called Scribble. And we started talking about, oh, you know, that may be a good path to teaching academics, because then they could write papers for, you know, non-computer science-y academics. You know, they could write their papers in this markup language. And, you know, if they learn Git and things like that, they can also check it into there.
Yeah, Scribble, you know, is the markup language that you use for Racket documentation.
That's right. So
and,
we ran
and you were looking at a way to have humanities people also write things in Scribble.
Right. So we ran this workshop and it was successful. But when I first sat down to be like, well, let's see how feasible this is. And I sat down and, you know, I've been working on a lot of things in Guile over the last few years. And I kind of looked at, once I sat down to play around with it, I kind of had this no moment. Like, as I was like, wait a minute, they've got this and they've got this and they've got this. And like, it was a large number of yaks that I thought I had to shave myself, that it turns out that Racket kind of came either as a third party library or very frequently in the standard library. I kind of think of Racket as kind of being the Python of Lisps. Like, it has a very wide standard library that you can, even without pulling in third party libraries, do like an astoundingly large amount of things with.
Yeah, so it's very batteries included. That's also my feeling. Like, you're implementing, oh, I need to talk to this web service or whatever. And then I wish I could just require JSON and then I would have a JSON read function. I'll just do that. Oh yeah, I do have it.
Yeah, exactly. And the GUI library is excellent. There's web tooling that comes built in. There's just a lot of things that I was like prepping myself for a few years of kind of yak shaving and Guile, and I was like, oh, it's already done in Racket. And I actually kind of almost got angry about it, because I thought, you know, like, well, like, I'm really devoted to Guile, but I felt like I couldn't justify that in a certain sense because there were so many nice things in Racket. So I was like, all right, you know what? I'm going to see how far I can go in Racket. And it turns out that the answer has been pretty far.
I also really love the community around Racket. Like, when I first created, when I started with this project Fractalite with Stuart and Dennis, my first task was to write Racket to Nix, because we are using Nix for the final composition of things. And so
a good choice.
Yeah. You and I met talking about geeks, and Nix is the forefather, and here I am 2 years later getting paid to do stuff in Nix. That's pretty awesome. So I wrote Racket to Nix, and Stuart told the mailing list, like, we're working on this thing. And then the same day, Matthias Feleisen, one of the professors working on the core of this language, went in and made a pull request, like, here, I fixed all your little style issues. This is how we write Racket. It was the most impressive response from a language community possible, I think. Like, here's one of the founders of the language, and he just told you how to write in this language, and he wrote it for you, and just, here, take this. So that's a good gift.
Yeah, I have to say, well, okay, I will say Guile's community was also very good in that the people were very friendly to me, and I felt like the maintainers were also guided me a lot and helped me a lot. But I guess part of the thing with Racket is that it's not exactly a mainstream language, but it's a little bit more mainstream, and it has a much larger and more stable set of things. And I guess partly because of that, I didn't expect the kind of community responses I've gotten to things. I've been, I think, like you, pretty surprised that if you go on the Racket mailing list and you're like, I want to do X, Y, and Z, there's like, you know, four or five, you know, like, I've had threads where I've had like, you know, four or five people that I considered like, you know, kind of programming language heroes respond about my stupid Racket problem. And that's kind of surprising.
Yeah, it's very, very accessible, and some very cool people are involved there. So that's very, it's kind of overwhelming when you start, and it's a very friendly feeling.
Yeah, so here's another, okay, actually, this is another reason why I got into Racket. One of the problems with Engile is that, and I think this is true of pretty much all Lisps, except is that with the Lisp machine pretty much gone, if you want to get into programming in a Lisp, the thing that somebody will tell you is, okay, first go learn Emacs, and then come learn this, and like learn all these different programming modes, and then come learn Lisp. And like that's a pretty high barrier entry. Whereas Racket comes with Dr. Racket, which like is made for middle schoolers to be able to do computer programming, and yet so like good enough that it can scale up to, you know, serious language researchers. And you also have Emacs if you want it. And the documentation is so good that I realized, oh, one of the challenges I was having in Guile was being able to get newcomers to come into a project who didn't have Scheme programming experience and be able to help get them acclimated. And, you know, with Media Goblin, we were using Python and we had a really easy time getting people started. And I was kind of like, oh, I could have that back again with Racket.
Oh, I definitely agree about the documentation. It's top notch, definitely.
Yeah. So I think I'm going to bring up,
I think we gushed enough about how awesome Racket is and why we're using it.
Yeah. I want to throw in two other things that are interesting.
About yeah, right.
One other thing that's interesting, and then one thing I'm going to complain about though. So one thing that's interesting about Racket is that it's very language focused in that, you know, and this is something you're taking advantage of more than I am because mine's kind of a library, but I think it's built with the intention of people being able to build lots of languages in it, right?
It comes with like 200 languages, and the Racket people talk about programming, language-oriented programming. I better link to that in the show notes. It's a pretty good article. But yeah, absolutely. It comes from it used to be called PLT Scheme, where PLT is the programming language theory department at MIT. So it pretty much comes with the territory that it's programming language oriented.
Yep. And I'd say that maybe if Racket has a problem, it's that it targets middle schoolers and programming language theorists. And there's like this large untapped middle ground that I think it hasn't tapped into, but totally could, which is I kind of consider kind of like the Python programmer style domain.
Sorry, I was typing. What were you saying?
I was saying that I think that Racket targets like middle schoolers and very young programmers, and also like on the other end of the spectrum, like programming language theorists. But there's this large middle ground that I think is kind of untapped. And I think that that's why Python is so successful in many ways, is that it really caters to people kind of just day to day being able to plug things together. And I think Racket could absolutely be an ideal fit for that middle area too, but I think isn't kind of marketing itself for it.
Right. So Python kind of lives in that that middle area. And I guess some people would take this as being condescending, but Python is a very good gluing language, and maybe Racket doesn't quite fill that niche, but it definitely could. I agree with that.
Yeah. And I mean, maybe focusing too much on languages actually doesn't help, because I'm not sure all languages, like Langs and Racket semi-compose, but not fully always. So that's something I've thought about. But I mean, Racket already has a really great amount of libraries, so I think it's not a problem. But anyway, the one downside I'd say to Racket is that it doesn't support live programming as much as other Lisps generally, in that it's... In other Lisps that I've worked with, you can kind of run the program and like you're doing web development or something, and you change the world around you. Or when I was working on MudSync, which was this live mud development environment for a multiplayer game, people could join the game and they could say, oh, it would be really cool if this was here, and I'd just add it. And like the language itself supported that. And Racket is almost kind of against that, because Racket wants you to recompile every module, and then you can play around in the REPL, but you can't redefine things that have already been there. But I guess there's been discussion on the mailing list, and I think Matthias has even expressed that, you know, maybe we could support that mode a little bit better.
Yeah, it's quite compile oriented, and I guess the compiler is allowed to make a lot of optimizations because it has all the information about the sort of final state of the module and what symbols are going to be there. So I think if I've understood the discussions on the mailing list correctly, then I think the way the REPL works is it creates new modules all the time where new definitions shadow the older definitions. So you got like a whole layer of modules under the hood, and you're always in the sort of latest module. And when you're redefining things, you're just adding another module on top and defining things there, and then sort of importing all the work you did up to this point. I think if I've understood correctly, that's how the REPL works. And that doesn't really work for a live process, because you would have to migrate the whole process into each of these new sort of module frames.
Right. That's my understanding as well. And I have an idea on maybe how we could do it, though I haven't actually tested it yet. And since Racket is so Lang-y, it might be possible to build another Lang, which is what Racket people called languages, that maybe like boxes function definitions so that you can actually just replace the contents of that box as you redefine things and stuff. But I don't know if it'll work or not, but that's something I'm very interested in exploring.
Okay, so now one of the other things you're exploring apart from actors and activity pub and all these things is also object capabilities. How does that fit into things?
So a lot of this is, so a way that most of our security ends up being designed is what is sometimes called perimeter security. So for example, kind of forms of perimeter security you're probably familiar with is your access control lists on your computer. If you're using a Unix-y type system, you've got your files are probably protected by users and groups and stuff like that. And then if in your browser, you've got like same origin policies and stuff like that. But the problem is that, so what object capability people like to say is that if you've, the problem with perimeter security is it's really eggshell security. If you, because you can just make a tiny pinprick in it and suck out the whole yolk. And some examples of that are, so if you have on your, imagine you've got libpng or some other image display program on your computer, and there's just the tiniest bug on libpng, just like super tiny, that's just like a little memory overflow problem or something like that. And if somebody can exploit that, they can have access to everything you can do, right? Not just blitting the wrong things on your screen, but everything, right? And if we took an object capability approach, that wouldn't happen. You would be instead able to just blit, you know, just some pixels and that's it. And similarly, in your browser, you've got, it's very difficult to control the same origin things, and bugs come up with that all the time. And so object capabilities is an alternative way of looking at security, which is very often ends up being the pure version of whatever programming language paradigm you're interested in. So for example, most programming languages are very lambda calculus-esque, which is you define a lot of procedures and the procedures can call other procedures and et cetera. So if we take away the top level, like we take away global variables, which people generally think is a good idea to remove global variables, and we end up passing around references to things. So your function may come in a module that has been initially been granted some access to some things, and then your functions only have access to the things that are passed into them effectively. Then at that point, we have object capability security, which is, you know, basically principle of least authority applied on a like programming language theory direction. Similarly with the actor model, if your actors only have references to the other actors that they should have access to, if they don't have global access to a bunch of other actors, then they can't call on other things that they shouldn't be able to have access to. So they can't, if you're, you know, that if we go back,
they can't like scan through memory and find everything that is there and go and wreak havoc.
Right, exactly. So you wouldn't, and it turns out it's possible to do this in operating systems as well. So if you're if you've got that image problem, that image program, it wouldn't be able to, you know, like crypto locker your file system or something like that. So object capabilities are very desirable in that it's a different paradigm. Instead of being identity-oriented security, which is how we're used to thinking about things like what can Clack do and what can Chris do?
Yeah, if you want to access my stuff, you need to become me, and then suddenly you have access to all my stuff.
Right. So instead of that, it's possession-based. It's like kind of like a car key. You've got your car doesn't care who you, I mean, in old school cars at least, your car doesn't care who you are. If you've got the key to turn on the car, then you can turn on the car, right? And it may sound cooler to have a car that can scan your face and say, you know, welcome, Chris, this is, you know, you may now drive. But it turns out that introduces more security vulnerabilities than the old version of things. And object capabilities also allow for delegation. So I could say, okay, Clock, you know, it's okay for you to drive my car. And I just make a copy of my key and I hand it to you and then you can drive, right? And I can also revoke that. I can press a button and it destructs your key and then you can't use it anymore. And if you had made a copy and given it to somebody else, it would destruct that copy effectively as well. And I can also attenuate it. So if, you know, there's a concept of a, some cars have that are really fancy have valet keys where they can only be driven a certain number of miles. So if I give, I can make a copy of my key, I can delegate it, but I can also attenuate that delegated copy, which means I put some caveats on it that say like, oh, you can drive this, but only until this mileage, which is 5 miles from here now. So now nobody can go on a joyride with my car, right? So with that kind of idea and by having kind of the possession-oriented reference to things, we can do some really powerful things and make things much more secure. And I'm currently working on a standard called OCAPLD. OCAP is the shorthand for object capabilities. So object capabilities for linking data. It's a standard for linked data systems so that we can bring object capability security to kind of web APIs and things like that.
All right, very cool. Yeah, I was just thinking when you're talking about the valet key and stuff, maybe most people haven't had that, but many internet banks these days offer you the ability to create a temporary virtual credit card. So like, I'm going to buy this thing from this company that I may or may not trust. It's going to cost $100. So I'm just going to create a virtual credit card that only allows one transaction for $100 and that's it. So even if their credit cards leak, my money is still safe.
Right. So credit cards are kind of like bearer capabilities in a certain sense. So bearer meaning like if you have access to it, you can do things. And OAuth 2.0 bearer tokens are also very similar.
Right. That was going to be my second example of things that people might have used OAuth.
Right. So we can. So the bank example is really good because let's point at a very dangerous thing that we don't want people to do, but people do all the time. Right. Which is like, are you familiar with Mint.com? M-I-N-T?
I don't know it, no.
Okay, so they're a budgeting application, and they are able to, they want to be able to give you, they want to analyze your purchasing habits, and then tell you, you know, you've been spending this much on this number, on like groceries, right? That makes sense, right?
Right.
Okay, so the problem is, you do the identity-oriented login and basically give them your credentials so they can log in as you. So you have to really trust Mint to not also withdraw money and things like that or transfer your money because they could in theory. But if it was an object capability type approach instead, we would be able to grant them a capability to just read your bank account but not be able to withdraw.
Yeah. All right. So we got your actors, you got your object capabilities. How does this fit into media sharing applications and how is Sprightly going to take over the world?
Before we talk about that, should we give an Activity Pub update since the world has changed dramatically since the last recording?
Oh, do go ahead.
Well, I don't even remember. Did we talk about Activity Pub in the last HPR?
No. That was 2 years ago. You were working with it, but it wasn't like near horizon. So we were just talking about geeks.
Oh, okay. So Activity Pub is a federated social network system. So that's a so if you wanted to have so right now in practice, if you wanted to have a Twitter alternative, Mastodon's an example of that. So is Pleroma, and you can speak to each other. And ActivityPub is a protocol that says, here's how these two different servers can talk to each other. What a lot of people don't realize is it's actually an actor model system. It's hinted a little bit by the fact that the different users on the network are called actors. But really, you're sending messages from actor to
and
actor
they have
across
inboxes.
These different servers. They have inboxes. So it's absolutely actor model system, which also means that we can make it an object capability system as well, though people aren't doing that. But anyway, what's exciting is that within the last couple years, I spent about 3 years at the W3C standardizing this. It got standardized, and Mastodon and Pleroma and PeerTube and a number of other things have picked it up. I think we're at near about 2 million users on the ActivityPub network or something.
Wow, cool.
I think. So it's been pretty more successful than I anticipated. Mastodon picking it up certainly helped its image recognition, I think, quite a bit. One of the things that we didn't do in ActivityPub was we didn't specify anything about access role, right? I can, if I know who you are, I can send you messages. Okay, fine. Theoretically, I can also block you and stuff like that if I want to, but that's kind of your server making that decision. And we describe the proper side effects for that and stuff. But but we don't specify anything about, like, let's say I want to create a mailing list type group, right? Let's say you and I want to curate a list of photos from FOSDEM. We start this group to curate these photos. How do I give you access to become a curator of that, right? There's nothing specified, right? Who has access to update that group? Who has access to delete content from it? None of that stuff is specified in ActivityPub.
Yeah.
And when we were working on ActivityPub, I thought this was a big mistake on our parts, and I just was kind of quiet about thinking it was a big mistake. And now I'm kind of like, oh, thank God. Because if we probably would have done some sort of awful, terrible distributed access control list, because that's kind of what I knew at the time, and it would have had confused deputy attack problems, and it would have had all sorts of things like that. And I think that since ActivityPub is an actor model system, we can layer on a bunch of really interesting object capability type things. So we could do that whole who has access to curate this gallery. Well, the gallery itself could be an actor. And if I give you an OCAPLD capability to curate it, then you would be able to do so, right? That's kind of the way that we can build in, kind of tie those things together. I guess I didn't bring up Sprightly, though. That was like three other things, so.
Yeah, so what is Sprightly?
Vaporware currently, that's one thing. The goal is, what happened kind of to my surprise is, I started working on ActivityPub because of Media Goblin, which I was working on decentralized media hosting, and ActivityPub was originally kind of oriented towards that. But to my surprise, a number of other projects have started working on that. There's Funk Whale, which is doing audio. There's PeerTube, which is doing video, and I know federates with Mastodon and Pleroma. And there's a few others like PixelFed. I don't remember if they have ActivityPub implementation working, but I know they were working on it. And Funkwell
was doing
audio.
Yeah, he doesn't federate yet. He doesn't want to federate until he's got a complete solution in place. He has a branch that does federation, but he doesn't want to activate it until he has all the sort of blocking and moderation and all that stuff in place.
Right. So I kind of feel like a lot of people are working on those things. And I kind of was like, well, what can I do that's more interesting for... So I also had an itch to do an activity pub implementation, which I had done part of one in Guile. And so I was like, well, I want to port that to Racket, and I want to do some more interesting things. So part of the idea... So this is kind of... This sounds spacey and futuristic, but what I'd like to do is build an activity pub server that's kind of generic, and an activity pub client that's fairly generic, so you can layer a bunch of interesting things on top of it. But the thing I'd like to do is build a distributed social game on top of it, which sounds crazy, but if you know, maybe if you listen to the last one or something, I think I might have talked about the mud I built on top of 8sync. So it's not that surprising that I'm interested in this. And also, I showed up at a conference at the W3C World Wide Web Consortium conference, and people were like, oh, well, what would you like to do if you had all the time to work on things? And I'm like, well, it's embarrassing, but I'd really like to do this distributed game thing. Well, what I found out is that almost...
There were a lot of embarrassing people in the room.
Yeah, there were a lot of people who... Well, also, a lot of this technology came out of that stuff, and I didn't know that at the time.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so object capability stuff. The most well-known actor model object capability system is called E. And where it comes from is Electric Communities. And Electric Communities was a semi-distributed online social network slash game that was built in the 90s. And in order to be able to manage this whole living world that people were walking around in and everything, and be able to allow people to program their own functionality in game and stuff like that and keep it secure, they had to use object capabilities. So that's where a lot of the object capability stuff has come from. And I also am talking with people who are kind of in the digital currency space, and I know a number of them were working on it in the 90s on distributed games and stuff like that, partly because it was an interesting way to research digital currency because you have to use it in games. So this kind of sounds crazy, and it could just remain vaporware. I hope it doesn't. My goal is, after I have more infrastructure written, to start experimenting with getting some of these, a lot of the technologies I'm working with, and get them running out the door with this as kind of a test bed. And one of the reasons for that is something that struck me is that...
So you mean you're using Sprightly as the sort of the driver to create things like goblins?
Right, exactly. The reason why this game stuff that I'm interested in implementing it is partly because... So one cool thing that people were doing recently with ActivityPub is they were running it over Tor Onion services. So that was happening in Pleroma. A few Pleroma instances were running over Tor Onion services, which I think is great, because that kind of bridges peer-to-peer and federated systems. And I think that that's a pretty cool thing.
Yeah.
One of the problems I think with peer-to-peer systems and stuff like that is that people always immediately think of kind of the nefarious uses of peer-to-peer systems. People are gonna start selling drugs on them, they're gonna do foobar baths and stuff like that. And also the other thing that struck me is that not many people are hosting federated social network servers. It would be interesting if we could get people hosting things without... So another problem is, if you show up on federated social networks, there are kind of two... it's great that Mastodon attracted a lot of people in the LGBT space, but really a lot of conversation on Mastodon. So Mikey, a friend of mine, made a comment a couple years ago, which is that federated social networks kind of tend to become a place that people end up discussing federated social networks. Which, okay, that's great. But do you want to talk to some people who are not kind of freedom diehards, right? Like, how do we get the network so that it's everybody, not just people who are really ideologically motivated? So I think one of the interesting ways to do that is to have freedom be a side effect of the of something else that people want to do. So what do people want a lot of servers of who are not self-hosting nerds? What's the most popular server that teenagers run around the world? Is Minecraft, right? Tons
right.
of kids run Minecraft. Yeah, so if you could create a world that other people can walk around in, and what's really appealing about Minecraft is that you can walk around the world and build things with friends, right? So if you were on MUDs in the 90s, there was a kind of a parallel aspect to this, which is that it wasn't just, it was a social network with a sense of space that you could walk around and do things. And also in many of these games, there was also the ability to kind of affect the world that you were walking around in. And I think that that may be an interesting avenue for having people run servers who don't think about themselves as, you know, specifically user freedom type people. And then the next time that, if you have it so that you could just click in Sprightly's, you know, GUI and say, spin up a game server, and people are just doing that everywhere. And somebody says, you know, the next time that, you know, some sort of, you know, politician is like, we need to shut down Tor, right? Because Tor is being used by blah, 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 all these bad people. Well, you could say, well, your kid runs Tor.
Yeah.
Your kid runs an onion service and they're not doing it for nefarious things. They just want to run a game with friends, right? So I think that normalizing these things, finding a kind of exciting angle for people to play around with things can be a fun way to get the distribution of these. But it's pretty ambitious. Who knows if I'll succeed or not. I've built most of these components individually. Building them together as one collective thing may be turn out to be challenging. But we'll see. It's also kind of something I've wanted to do for years. So since I'm not really being... I have a day job where I'm being paid to do related things, but nobody's paying me to work on social network things specifically right now. This is the thing that I'm motivated and excited to actually build, and I think it could be a real contribution if it happens.
Yeah, that's a whole HPR episode as well. Like, what's happening with virtual reality? When can we get our federated virtual reality network to replace the web or to complement it? That's a whole other tangent.
Right. And it doesn't have to be 3D to start out and make it interesting, right? So I'm interested in what's the lowest barrier to entry thing that people can start building things that they will participate in. And right now we've seen a big explosion in interactive fiction stuff again, mainly because Twine. I think it's called Twine. I'm forgetting the name exactly. I think it's called Twine. Is a like interactive fiction building application that makes it really easy for artists to make interactive fiction. And so it turns out this genre of games that was almost dead came back from the grave because it was so easy for people to just start building things again. And I think that's pretty cool. I'd like to do, if it was so easy for you to show up in something that's like a chat room, but instead of just offering your friend a drink by saying, you know, here's a drink, right? What if you paid a little bit of in-game currency and you got something that you would hand to them and then they would consume it and it had an effect on the world, right? And it had an effect on their character or something like that. It's much more fun when you've got a social network with a sense of space. And a lot of the social networks we have right now are degraded in comparison to the MUDs that we had in the 1990s. They have less functionality in that sense. And I think that's pretty interesting. How can we bring back the cyberpunk vision of social networks again?
Yeah, very cool. So is that what you're working on now, Sprightly and all that? That's your spare time. What are you doing when you get paid?
So I'm contracting half time for an organization called Digital Bazaar, and they do a bunch of decentralized identity and decentralized other type technology things. And it turns out some of the technologies that I was interested in overlapped with theirs. So I'm working on the object capability, the OCAP LD stuff. I'm actually getting paid to work on that. So tying that together with the activity pub and stuff is my job outside of work. But I do get paid in right now to do some standards work. And thankfully, Digital Bazaar, I'm pretty strict where I will only do free software development. And they are respecting my wishes there. And even though they do have some proprietary stuff that they do. And so I'm getting to work on libraries and stuff like that to advance some of this stuff.
Oh, that's very nice. I consider myself pretty much having the dream job now also. I'm making only free software. I'm creating tools for developers, and I'm scratching all the itches I have accumulated over the last 20 years of working in programming. like, I would like to have a better build system. Yeah, we're going to build a better build system. I'd like to have a better way to put code together with other code. Yeah, that's what we're developing. I want to make better distributed applications. Yeah, that's also part of what we're doing.
Very cool. Very cool. Well, it sounds like, well, we're like, we shouldn't go an hour long, and I think we just hit an hour. So do we need to wrap up?
I think we should wrap up. So you got some things you want to plug somewhere you want people to go?
Well, I'm going to be co-presenting at RacketCon with my spouse, Morgan Lemmer-Weber. We are going to be presenting on the workshops that we've been doing. And also, so we're going to be co-presenting a talk called Racket for Everyone Else. So it's kind of that very topic about, well, Racket has targeted these two communities, but there's a bunch of other groups of people who could really benefit from Racket. And Morgan's going to kind of focus on the humanities academic side of things. And I'm going to focus on the kind of, you know, the Python space of developers and stuff like that. And so I'm pretty excited about that.
Okay, cool. Yeah, what I'm working on these days is Fractalide. You can find us at fractalide.com. Our biggest challenge is to explain what it is we're doing. So let us know if you understand anything after visiting the webpage, and we'll try to make it more understandable as we go along.
Sounds great. And something that you and I are both doing is trying to get Racket better packaged in Nix and Geeks, respectively. So maybe once this episode ends, we should have a quick check-in on that.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Let's do that. Okay, this has been Christopher Lemmer-Weber, and we've been talking about object capabilities and flow-based programming and actor models and all other kinds of stuff that happened while we were talking about it, and all kinds of fodder for new episodes. But for now, this has been Hacker Public Radio. Na 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 na. You have been listening to Hacker Public Radio at hackerpublicradio.org. We are a community podcast network that releases shows every weekday, Monday through Friday. Today's show, like all our shows, was contributed by an HPR listener like yourself. If you ever thought of recording a podcast, then click on our contribute link to find out how easy it really is. Hacker Public Radio was founded by the Digital Dog Pound and the Infonomicon Computer Club, and is part of the Binary Revolution at binrev.com. If you have comments on today's show, please email the host directly, leave a comment on the website, or record a follow-up episode yourself. Unless otherwise stated, today's show is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Share Alike 3.0 license. Ba 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 ba